You're listening to an Airwave Media Podcast.
The world is constantly changing and transforming. Cut through some of the noise with What's New with Wired, a podcast that goes in depth on the latest news and technology and culture. Their award-winning journalism will help you make sense of what's happening in the world. Listen to What's New with Wired wherever you get your podcasts. That's What's New with Wired wherever you get your podcasts. We all know how important it is to keep your eye on the money, and not just your own. Stay on top of the latest financial and market news with Yahoo Finance, a podcast that releases new episodes almost every day. You'll hear a brief overview of the biggest news in the financial world, all in 3 minutes or less, right after markets close. Check out Yahoo Finance wherever you get your podcasts. That's Yahoo Finance wherever you get your podcasts.
This is Kick-Ass News. I'm Ben Mathis. With all the stresses of life, it can be easy to lose perspective on what really matters. But Heineken believes that life is about being with friends and opening yourself to new experiences. Because when you live spontaneously and embrace the unexpected, it's a chance to create new stories and connections. You just have to open it. So enjoy a refreshingly cold, full-bodied Heineken Lager today. With its deep golden color, light fruity aroma, mild bitter taste, and a crisp, clean finish. Cheers! And now, enjoy the podcast. Hi, I'm Ben Mathis. Welcome to Kick-Ass News. Folks, for the handful of you who've listened to this podcast from the very beginning, you might recall an early episode I did with Senator Lindsey Graham, who voiced his vehement opposition to the 2015 Iran nuclear agreement. At the time, I sided with Senator Graham, among other things, echoing the argument that Iran would be able to quickly ramp up its nuclear weapons program once the deal sunsets. And while Senator Graham, in a rare show of support for President Trump, endorsed the U.S. withdrawal from the deal in May of this year, I, on the other hand, did not. Why? First of all, I confess that I've never actually read the 101-page agreement, and over the past 3 years of doing this show, I've talked to many people who have read it, and the one thing that every leader in foreign policy, intelligence, and the military, on both the right and the left, hawks and doves alike, all agree on, the world was better off with a nuclear deal than without. I'm not afraid to admit that I was wrong, and that's why I'm welcoming Ambassador Wendy Sherman to the podcast. Among her many accomplishments during her years at the State Department, she was the lead negotiator on the Joint Comprehensive Plan of Action, better known as the Iran Nuclear Agreement, and she's written about that experience and many others in her new book titled Not for the Faint of Heart, Lessons in Courage, Power, and Persistence. Today she explains why she wanted to write more than just a memoir, but a book of practical lessons in leadership and negotiation. She says she's prepared for comparisons with Donald Trump's Art of the Deal, which, by the way, she has read, and she has some useful advice for the dealmaker-in-chief on how he could be a much more effective negotiator with both our allies and our adversaries. She recalls working with Secretary of State Madeleine Albright to halt North Korea's nuclear ambitions in the 90s and how they came so close to an agreement, only to see their efforts derailed by the chaos of the 2000 election. She explains why negotiating with North Korea is always one part diplomacy and one part absurdity. She recalls her personal interactions with the dear leader, Kim Jong-il, and weighs in on how his successor and son, Kim Jong-un, measures up. Then, Ambassador Sherman talks about the many months of diplomacy, both covert and overt, that went into the nuclear agreement with Iran, how much was lost when President Trump decertified the deal, and what her colleagues across the negotiating table are saying about it now. She explains why the negotiation was a lot like solving a Rubik's Cube, just how heated things got behind closed doors, and why sometimes tactics are no substitute for pure, raw human emotion. Coming up with Ambassador Wendy Sherman in just a moment. Amb- Ambassador Wendy Sherman served as a high-level diplomat and advisor in the State Department during both the Clinton and Obama administrations. She's one of the few people who have sat across the negotiating table with North Korea and Iran, and indeed in 2015, she was the lead negotiator on the Iran nuclear agreement. She brings her years of wisdom and experience to her new book called Not for the Faint of Heart, Lessons in Courage, Power, and Persistence. Or as I like to call it, the anti-art of the deal. Ambassador Sherman, welcome to the podcast.
Thank you. It's great to be with you, Ben.
Well, I joke, but the book is a little different from the typical memoir in that you present your story in the format of lessons in negotiating and leadership. I'm sure that you're prepared for the likelihood that readers and also the press will draw contrast between your book and that of a certain self-proclaimed deal maker in chief.
Indeed. You know, soon after the president was elected, I was going through Dulles Airport in Washington, D.C., outside of Washington, which I do often because I travel a great deal both in this country and around the world. And I saw The Art of the Deal in paperback and figured I ought to read it and see what it was about. And, you know, negotiating, building a building is sort of a little different than negotiating war and peace. When you build a building, if it doesn't get built, people go live someplace else and you go on to another project. The stakes are a little different when it's the national security of your country.
For sure. The book is structured in terms of lessons that you've learned and want to impart. And one of the biggest points that you drive home in the book, and also wherever you speak to students and aspiring diplomats, you say that you wish them an unexpected life. You're a great example of that. Tell us a little bit about your winding path that led you from being a social worker to politics and ultimately diplomacy.
Right. I'm quite fortunate and lucky. Luck is important in life. But what I think is really important is to get a core set of skills, is what I say to young people, and then use that core set of skills for whatever opportunities come your way. So one of the things that I did was get a graduate degree in social work as an organizer, and I only half joke that my clinical skills are very helpful with members of Congress and dictators. But I used that core set of skills first as the director of child welfare in the state of Maryland when I was quite young, really had to learn how to deal with very difficult issues like child abuse and foster care, institutional care for kids, which has really come home to me as I watch these separated families over the last few months where little children have been pulled apart from their parents in their attempt to seek asylum in this country. It just totally breaks my heart. But I went on from that through a friendship developed with a Baltimorean, which is where I'm from, Barbara Mikulski,
right,
and went to Washington to become her chief of staff. Ultimately ran her campaign for the U.S. Senate, her successful campaign, really proud to have been part of that. And having organized that using my organizing skills, I worked on presidential campaigns. I was a partner in a Democratic media consulting firm. And then I got a call from a political colleague, Tom Donilon, who was then a lawyer, went on to be national security advisor for President Obama some years later. And Tom said, it was a Sunday night, I was having dinner with some friends at home. He said, would you come in and see Warren Christopher tomorrow? It was going to be Martin Luther King's birthday. And I couldn't imagine why Warren Christopher, who was going to become Bill Clinton's first Secretary of State, wanted to see me. But I thought, well, what the heck? You know, one of the things in my book is a chapter on letting go. And although that has some sad parts to it, it's also about letting go maybe from what you're doing and risking opening yourself up to a new opportunity. So I went to see Chris, and to make a long story short, he wanted me, if the president agreed, to become the Assistant Secretary for Legislative Affairs, to, in essence, lobby on Capitol Hill for the U.S. government's State Department on foreign affairs and national policy. And I said to him, also a lesson I say to young people, be honest about what you can do and what you can't do. I said, if you want someone who knows everything about national security and foreign policy, I might not be the person. I know some things because you can't do electoral politics without learning some things. But I wasn't an expert. But if you want someone who knows Washington and knows Capitol Hill, I might be that person. So indeed, I was confirmed to be the Assistant Secretary for Legislative Affairs. I then went on later to work with a good friend and colleague who became the first woman Secretary of State, Madeleine Albright, to be her counselor, where I got to negotiate with North Korea. Then with then-former Secretary Albright and some other colleagues, started a business because we wanted to try to help countries develop a middle class, which would then buy American products. And U.S. investment was important around the world. So we built an international global consulting business. And then I was very lucky to be asked by Hillary Clinton to come in and to be the Undersecretary for Political Affairs with President Obama's agreement. Was confirmed again and was there for 4 years. And now I'm back in the consulting business and doing various other things as well. And soon, the next chapter in my unexpected life was just announced yesterday, and that is I'm going to head to Harvard in January to be a professor in practice in public leadership and director of the Center for Public Leadership, succeeding David Gergen. A difficult set of shoes to step into, but I'm very excited.
That's right. I just read that. Congratulations on that. Now, when you made your leap from the legislative branch to the State Department, certainly it must have been quite a crash course in foreign policy. I'm sure that you knew quite a bit, but to the level that you're then going to have to be able to go back and forth and brief Congress and the Senate on various pieces of the Clinton foreign policy, how much work did you have to do to catch up to speed?
Enormous amount of work. And one of the chapters in the book is about persistence. These things aren't simple. Negotiations aren't simple. Tweets won't do the job, quite frankly. You really have to study and learn. I'm very fortunate. I have a terrific short-term memory. I have a really lousy long-term memory, but I can cram a lot into my head. And my staff would give me enormous briefing books, and I would go home and I would learn everything. I would have murder boards with people throughout the State Department to make sure I understand the nuances of subjects. And being the Assistant Secretary for Legislative Affairs was a great learning space for what I subsequently did in national security and foreign policy, because I had to learn about every single subject on the face of the earth.
Now, you mentioned that one of your big tasks in your portfolio under Madeleine Albright was the denuclearization of North Korea. In the book, you talk about how at the time, pretty much everyone in the State Department was convinced that Kim Jong-il's regime was on the verge of imminent collapse. That obviously didn't happen. Was that just cockiness, or what was the rationale behind that theory?
Well, we actually had a meeting as Secretary Albright was becoming Secretary of State. And I said I'd like to, as her counselor, work on the Korean Peninsula. And everyone in the room believed that there was no way that this despotic regime, which had no economy to speak of, its people had enormous malnutrition, really starving, literally to death. There's a whole generation out of a famine in the 90s that has a stunted growth and stunted intellect. And so we couldn't imagine that it would continue. We were wrong. Subsequent administrations have thought the same thing, just put a little pressure on and they would fall over. But North Korea is a culture of what they call juche, self-reliance. And it is an ideology that says if we have to starve to protect our regime, to ensure our future, starve to build nuclear weapons and long-range missiles, that's what we're going to do.
And you traveled to North Korea a couple of times, I think, and there's a great quote in here about your experience negotiating with North Korea. You say, dealing with North Korea always involves one part normal diplomacy and one part absurdity. Give us a couple examples of the surreal experiences you had in Pyongyang.
Truly surreal. The first trip, I went with former Secretary of Defense Bill Perry, who was leading for President Obama a process to look at our policy and see if we couldn't get back on track. We were concerned about the testing of missiles that were getting longer and longer ranges. We were concerned that if North Korea went back to trying to get a nuclear weapon, at the time they had no nuclear weapons, that we were quite concerned. And so I went with Bill to North Korea, and one of the things we did, they wanted to show us their rice paddy and their hard workers. So we went to that rice paddy, and there were revolutionary signs all along the border of the rice paddy field They were using oxen and a plow. But the really absurd part of that is at one end of the field was a band in white dress uniform playing military songs. Now, I don't think that happens on a normal basis. It was quite bizarre. It was meant to say to us how proud they were of their agriculture, which was pathetic, quite frankly, and what they were able to do. And then, of course, there is the very famous story when Secretary Albright went, the highest-ranking official until Secretary Pompeo matched that, and obviously then when President Trump met with Kim Jong-un, the current leader, the son of Kim Jong-il. When we went to Pyongyang, it was extraordinary. We had no embassy there, no people there. We had to bring everything over land, including U.S. Marine guards. And we were in a meeting and were told we were going to go with Kim Jong-il to something quite special. We had no idea what it was. We were put in cars. The next thing we were knew, we were entering Rangaro Stadium, which is an enormous stadium, to 10 minutes of cheers for Kim Jong-il while we sort of plastered awkward smiles on our face, or very frozen smiles, to look diplomatic but not cheering and clapping. But in front of us were literally on the floor of that stadium hundreds of acrobats and somersaulters, and across from us, literally hundreds of people with flip cards, and with those flip cards making scenes of the revolution, of how great the country was. And one in particular was a set of flip cards that demonstrated a Taepodong missile, the missile we were concerned about, being launched. And Kim Jong-il turned first to the secretary and then to me and said, perhaps that will be the last time that missile does launch.
Wow. Yeah, I remember Kim Jong-il certainly had a flair for the cinematic in these big public events with casts of thousands. What were your impressions of the dear leader?
Well, we all together had about 12 hours with him, some in bilateral negotiations, some in events. It's very hard to have a great big feast when you know people are starving. So it was rather difficult and a bit awkward, but one does what one must under those circumstances. He was quite knowledgeable when the secretary went down a list of 14 questions we had about their missile program. He was quite knowledgeable. He knew the detail. He only turned to my counterparts, Kang Sok-joo, once or twice. The only other person in the room with him was an interpreter. So he was very self-confident, quite transactional. We thought we were on our way to a deal, but unfortunately, the Clinton administration ran out of time.
Right.
And subsequently, the Bush administration decided not to pursue what we had negotiated.
Yeah, I think that you described that as your biggest disappointment in your career, because you and Secretary Albright were getting pretty close to a deal, right down to the wire. I think you were negotiating. And then the chaos of the 2000 election happens. How did that change things for you?
Well, it was very hard. I think, you know, one of the things for all of us in life is letting go. We like to imagine we're in control of a number of things. And, of course, there's a lot we are not in control of. I've had some personal tragedy in my family that really taught me in a very painful and personal way that lesson, and I talk about that in the book. But in diplomatic terms, seeing that, in fact, something that you've worked so hard on, you've come so close to, and you simply run out of time, and the president at the time was also working to try to get Middle East peace, something he also had to let go of because at the last moment, Arafat could not say yes, you have to sort of understand that you don't get to complete the cycle, and history is not very kind, unfortunately, to diplomacy because events happen. Presidents change. Even military wars are not forever. When World War I was fought, the war to end all wars, we thought it was the war to end all wars. But about 20 years later, we had World War II, just as catastrophic, if not more so, because of the Holocaust and the genocide perpetrated. We had war yet again. So it's very hard, and one has to believe that history may turn again, and we'll get to the right place. President Trump is finding out how hard it is to do that. And we'll see what comes next.
Yeah. Now, when Kim Jong-il died and his son assumed power, the hope was that he was going to be a reformer, he was going to ease up on human rights and perhaps want to rejoin the world community. He had been Western educated. It was a similar argument to what some people were saying about Bashar al-Assad. Do you see much daylight between Kim Jong-un and Kim Jong-il, or is he pretty much cut from the same mold as his father?
I think he's cut from the same mold as his father, and probably even more so his grandfather.
Oh, really?
Who was quite a military first leader. He also, however, Kim Il-sung, his grandfather, the founder of modern, so to speak, North Korea after the Korean War, was on the verge himself of trying to have a summit with South Korea, but died before he was able to accomplish that. And then his son, Kim Jong-il, took over and sort of began all over again. Kim Jong-un is a brutal dictator, very publicly brutal. Within weeks of becoming the leader of his country, he executed his uncle. We all are well familiar with the two women in Malaysia in the airport who executed his half-brother. So he is very brutal and publicly so. That said, I think we saw a little bit of a glimmer of his Western education in the Singapore summit with President Trump. And before that, his summit with the President Moon Jae-in of South Korea, because he understands how to sort of work Western diplomats. He understands the symbolism and the theater of it all. His father, of course, was great at theater. He had every Academy Award film, as well as every Michael Jordan basketball game in his living quarters to be able to watch. So theater, drama is all part of what he believes. And one of the reasons I actually supported the summit in Singapore is because in North Korea, there really is only one decision maker, and that is the leader of the country. There is no real parliament. There is no free press, of course. There is no we the people. And Donald Trump, although there are checks and balances in our system, believes he is the only decider. And I thought these two men might be able to reach something, but only if there was a plan, very detailed, a strategy, and a team to follow up. And we've seen that none of that has really existed. The documents out of that Singapore summit were quite thin. And we have seen the outcome of that thinness. We're not only back to almost ground zero, but perhaps even a little behind.
Yeah, it's interesting to contrast the 101, I think, page document that was the Iran nuclear agreement with what came out of the Singapore summit. I think it was like a one or two page agreement.
Exactly. And it didn't even have a denuclearization agreement, denuclearization language, which was basically in every other document produced in the past. So quite a thin document, and I'm glad that the president has, with Secretary Pompeo, brought on an envoy, and I understand they are now setting up and standing up a team, but quite frankly, all of that should have been in place, as well as a detailed strategy. You know, the book is called Not for the Faint of Heart, because life is not for the faint of heart. There are glorious moments, but also every family, every person faces trials and tribulations. And diplomacy is certainly not for the faint of heart. People talk about diplomacy as soft power, but when it is done right, it is smart, it is tough, it takes persistence, it takes a team, it takes a great deal of courage and understanding of power. So it truly is not for the faint of heart, and you may think you get done, and then you might have to get done yet again.
We're going to take a quick break, and then I'll be back with more with Ambassador Wendy Sherman. When we come back in just a minute. Hiring used to be hard. Multiple job sites, stacks of resumes, a confusing review process. But today, hiring can be easy, and you only have to go to one place to get it done. ZipRecruiter.com/kick. As a small business owner, I've been through the hiring process before, and I know how grueling it can be when you're trying to find a good candidate who's the right fit for your organization. Sifting through unqualified applicants, going back and forth, and all the dead ends amount to wasted time and productivity. I'm all about making things as efficient as possible, and I know my listeners are too. With their powerful matching technology, ZipRecruiter sends your job to over 100 of the web's leading job boards and scans thousands of resumes to find people with the right experience to apply. As applicants come in, ZipRecruiter analyzes each one and spotlights the top candidates so you never miss a great match. ZipRecruiter is so effective that 80% of employers who post on ZipRecruiter get a qualified candidate through the site within the first day. With results like that, it's no wonder that ZipRecruiter is the highest-rated hiring site in America. And right now, my listeners can try ZipRecruiter for free at this exclusive web address, ZipRecruiter.com/kick. That's ZipRecruiter.com/KICK. ZipRecruiter.com/kick. ZipRecruiter, the smart way to hire. Are you looking for expert coverage and analysis of the NFL this season? Look no further. NFL Podcasts has you covered. Interested in the latest news from around the league? The Around the NFL podcast crew has exclusive access to industry insiders and team personnel, allowing you, the listener, to feel in on all the action. Perhaps you'd like to hear more of your favorite analysts and players break things down on and off the field. Then don't miss out on the Dave Damashek football program, as Damashek and his guests operate on a strict no-jive policy. Only honest, unfiltered opinions allowed. Maybe you're more devoted than the average NFL fan? If so, be sure to catch the Move the Sticks podcast, hosted by former NFL scouts Daniel Jeremiah and Bucky Brooks. As the NFL preseason continues to heat up, make sure to follow along with NFL podcasts for bold predictions and insights into who will be the next big star. Subscribe now to Around the NFL, the Dave Damashek football program, and Move the Sticks on your favorite podcast app or NFL.com. Life can be stressful, and sometimes we lose perspective on what really matters. As we rush to achieve all the things we want in life, it can be easy to forget to enjoy the smaller moments along the way. But life isn't about following a common path or having a set plan. It's about being with friends, celebrating with loved ones, and living in the moment. Heineken believes that you create the richest memories when you embrace the unexpected and open yourself to new experiences. That's why Heineken encourages everyone to live spontaneously. Because when you embrace the unexpected, things like exploring new parties, enjoying the summertime, watching exciting soccer matches, and celebrating the holidays with your family, all become chances to create new stories and connections. You just have to open it up. So enjoy a refreshingly cold, full-bodied Heineken Lager today, with its deep golden color, light fruity aroma, mild bitter taste, and a crisp, clean finish. Cheers! And now, back to the podcast. You have a chapter about power in your book. We tend to think of power, and certainly Donald Trump seems to think of power in terms of being a blunt instrument. But you say something interesting in here. You say power is used best when it empowers the weaker party to do what's right.
You know, someone who really understood that was Yitzhak Rabin, the prime minister of Israel.
Yes.
Who said famously that he understood that he had to help Arafat have enough power to be a partner. He had to hold him up. And in fact, in 1995, when Rabin was assassinated by someone in his own country, by a right-wing Israeli who did not want to see peace coming, many people thought it was the end of any ability to move forward, and it's been very tough ever since. But what I think President Obama understood in the Iran negotiation, for instance, was that we needed, and Secretary Kerry, Secretary Moniz, me and my team, is that you need to leave everyone with enough power so that they can make an agreement durable. They can deal with their politics at home. And even though the United States was the preeminent power in the Iran negotiation, the deal could not have been made without us. We are the military force that would have had to take action if diplomacy did not work. We had the strongest economic sanctions possible, though Europe certainly played an enormous role, as did others around the world. Nonetheless, every other party at the table had a veto power, had a power to change the direction of the negotiation, and even President Rouhani of Iran had to be left with enough power so that he could sell the deal at home.
Yeah, and the official negotiations drug on for, I think, nearly a month in Vienna. They were incredibly complex, and you often liken the experience of working with Iran and our partners in the P5 plus one to solving a Rubik's Cube.
Yes.
Explain that analogy for us.
I'd say two things. I used a Rubik's Cube because the Iran negotiation, which was so complicated, had so many technical elements to it, that like a Rubik's Cube, if you moved one piece, then it changed all the other pieces. So the press would say to me, what are the odds we're going to get the deal? And I would say, we're either going to get it or we're not, because you could get to 99%. And if you couldn't get that last piece to pop into place like a Rubik's Cube, you didn't have a deal. You didn't solve the puzzle. And I also described it in the following way. To do these very complex negotiations, to use the Iran example, I negotiated within the Obama administration. I negotiated with Capitol Hill. I negotiated bilaterally with each member of the P5 plus one, our negotiating partners. I negotiated with Israel. I negotiated with the Gulf states. I negotiated with non-governmental organizations who had something to say about nuclear weapons and missiles. Oh, and yeah, occasionally I negotiated with Iran. It is a very, very complex, labor-intensive process, and most of the people who were in this negotiation, including myself, were multitasking all the time because as Undersecretary of Political Affairs, I had responsibility for the whole world. So even while I was doing the Iran negotiation all 4 years I was Undersecretary, I went to 54 other countries, some of them multiple times. So it takes an understanding of power, the use of power. It takes a persistence, finding common ground with people across the table, building a great team, and of course, working the process to get to success.
I don't think that a lot of people understand that these were not bilateral negotiations, not only the P5 plus one, but you had a whole host of involved parties, such as the Saudis and Israel,
right,
that you had to deal with. It speaks to something that I think is sorely lacking right now, which is the power of global cooperation and coalition building.
Absolutely. You know, George Shultz, when he was Secretary of State, famously talked about the importance of gardening, that you have to go out,
right,
and sort of work the soil to make sure,
yes,
that when there is a crisis, you have partners, you have allies. And what we're seeing, going back to your North Korea example now, is that we are diverging from the very people that we need. China has the most economic leverage over North Korea. So when the president imposes tariffs, it's going to have an impact on whether China is going to cooperate with us on North Korea. It doesn't mean you have to choose one or another, but you have to work it very carefully to be able to move forward and think about what leverage you have, because you can never forget the other side's got leverage too. And that's true in our personal relationships and in life as well. You know, the difference, Ben, between an autocrat and a diplomat is that when you're a diplomat, you weigh things, you choose your words, you think about what you're doing, you plan for them, and know that you're going to have to change your plans. An autocrat often acts impulsively without checks and balances. Diplomats understand that everything you're doing is grounded in history, in culture, in the way the world works, and that you're really working for the future, not just for the immediately what's in front of you, which is how an autocrat moves forward. So we've got very difficult times right now, and we cannot forget about our allies, our partners, and those who really make our enormous strength even greater.
And a lot of this coalition building in the lead up to the official Iran negotiations took place behind closed doors. And you had, just to get to that point, I think months of back channel negotiations and secret meetings all over the world. It's a little bit James Bondish. That's the kind of thing that used to be common in diplomacy, but the public increasingly demands transparency and that important talks be done in the light of day. And of course, anytime high level meetings take place behind closed doors, the conspiracy theorists go wild.
Mm-hmm.
Is there still some value to back channel diplomacy and a certain degree of secrecy?
Absolutely. The Oslo Accords for Middle East peace were done in secret. Cuban negotiations, both by Bill Clinton and Barack Obama, began in secret. The Iran negotiations, as you point out, had been negotiated between Great Britain, France, Germany, and Iran in the early 2000s. And then it became a UN resolution that said all the permanent members of the Security Council, so including China, Russia, Great Britain, France, the United States, and then plus Germany, since they'd been part of the original negotiations, along with the European Union coordinating, should all work together to move forward. But we understood that the United States needed to get some traction to see if something real could happen here. And so Secretary Clinton, President Obama made a very tough decision, actually based on some contact that then chairman of the Foreign Relations Committee, John Kerry, had with the Sultan of Oman to act as a go-between with Iran. Out of that relationship, Secretary Clinton sent a couple of her colleagues to see whether there was something real here. There was a sense, particularly after President Rouhani was elected of Iran, slightly more moderate, though a very conservative cleric nonetheless, not moderate in our terms, but in Iranian terms, was elected. The president then decided to ask Bill Burns, who was Deputy Secretary of State, Jake Sullivan, who was by then National Security Advisor for Joe Biden, had been Secretary Clinton's head of policy planning, to lead a small group to see if we couldn't get some traction on at least an interim plan that would give us time to negotiate the whole plan. And it was understood that at some point that bilateral secret channel would be brought into the multilateral channel. That would fall to me to do, and so I started to join those secret negotiations towards the end, and we brought a bracketed text to the P5 plus one. I'm not sure I want to give away the story in the book, but when we did that with the foreign ministers, we didn't initially get a particularly great reaction. It ultimately did get to a place where everyone could agree and create the space and time to get the full joint comprehensive plan of agreement. But those secret channels are quite critical. And I think people are amazed that one can still do that in a 24/7 media world where people seem to know everything that's going on. You actually can still do these things.
Now, there must have been times when this drug on, when you had doubts and things got heated. I wonder, was there ever any truth to the stories that there was shouting during the negotiations and supposedly the Secret Service had to rush into the room because they were afraid the Iranian foreign minister was attacking John Kerry?
Well, there were a couple of times. One time at the Palais Coburg in Vienna, where we held both a summer set of talks in 2014 and then in 2015, when we finally came to conclusion, I spent 26 days at the Palais Coburg, ate exactly one meal outside of the hotel. There was an evening where Secretary Kerry and Foreign Minister Zarif of Iran were in a room, and it got quite heated such that some of my colleagues from other countries were concerned and let the secretaries detail know that they were concerned. And basically what they went in and said is, everyone can hear what you're saying. So there was that. There was a time when we had a very tough bilateral meeting in Geneva after the Supreme Leader of Iran seemed to undermine what had been agreed to in Lausanne, creating parameters for a final agreement. So we met with the Iranians. We always had Helga Schmidt, the deputy of the European Union's high representative, join us so that our colleagues would know we weren't doing things behind their backs, and had some transparency. So we met bilaterally, and there was such a tough moment that Secretary Kerry banged his fist down on the table. He doesn't get angry very easily, got really angry, and his pen flew across the table and hit my counterpart, Abbas Arachi, with that flying pen. Not a great thing in diplomacy. Wow. Everybody understood that was inadvertent, and we got past it. And it probably sobered everybody up a little bit that we had to get serious about what we were doing.
And you actually opened the book by telling a great story about day 25 in Vienna. And you've got the deal, and you're at the 11th hour. The Iranians want to renegotiate a point, and you just, at that point, you're mentally exhausted, and you lose your cool a little bit and actually show some vulnerability during the negotiations. But it ends up being a good thing. And it's a great story because I love that it sort of illustrates that no matter how much you follow the rule book on negotiating, there's always that human element that can change the game.
Absolutely. Negotiations can't be reduced to a single set of techniques. You have to deal with the people in front of you. And very importantly, I think generally in life, when you bring your authentic self, you're at your most powerful. Sometimes you don't even know it. In the story you're telling, we were negotiating the UN resolution, which we'd left to the end because the United States, the Western European countries, had one view, which there had to be strict limits on arms and missiles and some other things, but China and Russia didn't want any limits. So we left it to the end when people would have to find a compromise. But it was a bilateral negotiation because on UN resolutions on Iran, the United States holds the pen, so to speak. I was in this room with Rob Malley, my deputy at the time, a really phenomenal colleague.
Oh, yeah. And yeah, we had him on the show. He's wonderful.
Yeah, he's just, I call him the Zen dad. He's just a marvelous human being. We were sitting with Abbas Arachi and Majid Ravanchi, Zarif's deputies and my counterparts. I thought we had gotten to an agreement. They accepted and some ideas I'd put on the table. And then Rachi leaned forward and said, one more thing. And I did lose it because I was supposed to actually go to Harvard to be a fellow for the fall as a way to sort of, I'd announced my retirement at the end of these negotiations. And we were already past the time we thought we would end these negotiations. I clearly wasn't going to get to Harvard on time. I was, as you said, exhausted. I was furious. And I just said, enough. And somewhere, I think this is true for a number of women, I learned it's not nice to be angry. And so what happens to me is I start to cry. So here I was angry, the lead negotiator, with tears coming down my face. They had no idea what to do with me. I'm not even sure Rob knew what to do with me. This wasn't a Wendy they'd ever seen before. And it did, I think, send the message to Arachi, though, we were out of time and out of corners, and it was time to be done. And so he withdrew his objection, and we completed that particular negotiation.
Now, critics point out that the agreement was to expire over time, and then Iran could ramp up the program with a few steps up. They point to the money that Iran gets from the removal of sanctions that possibly helps fund terrorism. And I have to be honest, even at the time, I expressed some skepticism of it, although I hadn't read the 101-page agreement. But what has convinced me over time is pretty much every single person in the intelligence community and foreign policy and the military that I've talked to has said we were better off with the agreement than we would have been without it. How much damage does President Trump's exit from the agreement do?
I think it's quite a bit of damage. I think we're seeing some of that now. We have split our alliance with Europe. And, you know, we are strongest when we act with Europe, whether that's about China, whether that's about Russia, whether that's about Iran. And so for us to not be in common cause is really a problem. And they're our largest trading partner. So we are hurting ourselves economically as well by weakening that alliance. Secondly, we are setting up a situation where Russia and China become the go-to people for Iran. How can that possibly be good for United States national security? It's not clear that other than trying to put sanctions back into place, which will create problems for the Iranians, that there is any plan to deal with Iran if they start back towards what they would need to do to get enough fissile material for a nuclear weapon. So far, Iran has not gone down that road, in part because I think they don't want President Trump to win. He would obviously say, I told you so. They're going to go back to building nuclear weapons. And in so without a plan, without a way forward, it's hard to know where this story ends. And heaven only knows we don't want war, which becomes a possibility more and more over time, because what are your alternatives? Sanctions start to fray over time. Even now, the Europeans are trying to find a way for small and medium companies to stay invested in Iran and go around U.S. economic sanctions. China will undoubtedly import oil that they shouldn't under the U.S. oil embargo, which will be back in place at the beginning of November. So we really are without a strategy. And if, in fact, we went ahead and bombed their facilities, which some of our partners and allies would like us to do, I believe, they would rebuild them, because you can't bomb away knowledge. They know how to do what they know how to do. So they would rebuild them, and they could do that in 2 or 3 years, and then we'd have to bomb them again. And they would have done so probably in secret and underground, so it would take us time to find those facilities. So I'm actually not at all sure where we're headed. If the administration believes that the sanctions will create an uprising in Iran, Iran is very good, painfully, at oppressing its people. We have lost a channel of communication that might help us solve and put pressure on Iran for its very nefarious and malign behavior in the Middle East, which is terrible, and we need to stop.
Well, before we go, real quickly, you have a couple of times, I think, met with your former negotiating partners from the P5 plus one and Iran at various speaking events and policy conferences. What is the mood like among them, considering that many of them are still in government and may have some impact on this? Do they have a strategy?
Well, I do think that the Europeans, Russia, China have met with Iran countlessly. There is a joint commission that the U.S. was part of but is no longer, obviously, because we've withdrawn, or the president has withdrawn us from it. And so they are trying to put a strategy together. Iran is looking to see how much oil they'll be able to export. They're looking to see whether there will be investment by small and medium companies. The large companies have all left, the Total, Allianz, Peugeot, Siemens. They've all left because they need the U.S. market more than they need the Iranian market. But small and medium enterprises might have a shot. But I think once all the sanctions are back in place at the beginning of November, it will be very tough. My guess is at the UN General Assembly in late September, there will be a lot of discussion about this and a lot about how we go forward. And of course, one of the objections that the president had was Iran's behavior in the region. That hasn't gotten any better. That's not about dollars, because it was Iranian money that was frozen. We didn't give U.S. taxpayer money to Iran as part of this deal. It doesn't take a lot of money to provide some support to the Houthis in Yemen or to have forces in Syria. So it's not clear to me what the strategy in the Middle East is either.
Well, the book is just excellent. There are a lot of great lessons and stories in it. Once again, Ambassador Wendy Sherman's book is called Not for the Faint of Heart, Lessons in Courage, Power, and Persistence. Ambassador Sherman, thanks so much for talking with me.
Thank you, Ben. Really appreciate it.
Thanks again to Ambassador Wendy Sherman for coming on the podcast. Her book, Not for the Faint of Heart, Lessons in Courage, Power, and Persistence, is available starting Tuesday, September 4th on Amazon, Audible, or wherever books are sold. Follow Ambassador Sherman on Twitter at Wendy R. Sherman. Support for today's show comes from Google Play. Did you know that you can now download and listen to audiobooks on Google Play? That's right. With hands-free listening using Google Assistant or Chromecast, you can enjoy thousands of titles a la carte, no subscription necessary. There's even multi-device integration across the Google ecosystem. And for a limited time, you get $10 off your first one over $10 by visiting g.co/play/kick. That's g.co/play/kick. Find your story with audiobooks on Google Play. If you haven't already, be sure to subscribe to Kick-Ass News on iTunes and leave us a review. You can follow us on Facebook or on Twitter at Kick-Ass News Pod. And as always, I welcome your comments, questions, and ideas at comments@kickassnews.com. I'm Ben Mathis, and thanks for listening to Kick-Ass News. Kick-Ass News is a trademark of Mathis Entertainment, Inc.